Welcome to Hyperfixation, a queer fandom podcast. My name is Marika.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Cal.
All right, and this week's Hyperfixation is Carmilla, the first lesbian vampire, or mostly just the novel Carmilla in the story, kind of in general.
Yes.
So to start us out, before I made you guys read the novella, which is mostly what we're talking about today, what was your guys' familiarity with the story of Carmilla? Or the character, I guess.
So I knew, like, the basics. So I've always been the, like, gay vampire kid. Mm-hmm. So I knew the basics that, like, she was a vampire. And, like, but, like, I didn't know the story as a whole. When you were, like, into the, like, web series thing, I knew that it was, like, the lesbian vampire. And I knew that that was from, like, an old book. So I knew that. I, like, knew pretty much just that she was a lesbian vampire. And that, like, she's prolific and one of the first kind of literary vampires that changed, like, from where we, from, like, scary creature to, like, kind of sexy creature. Mm-hmm. She's kind of, like, the first for that move for two vampires.
Yeah, I knew she shared similarities to, like, Bloody Mary in some of the, like, older ones. Because she's based off of, I actually looked up the name of the countess, but Elizabeth Bathory, who...
Are you going to talk about this?
You can keep going.
I was going to say, I knew that she was, like, yeah... Isn't she based off the woman who, like, killed kids and bathed in their blood to stay young forever?
That's kind of more of a rumor, and also that whole story about Elizabeth Bathory might not really be true and actually be propaganda on people in the village who didn't like her.
Right.
But,
I was going to say, I know that, like, we speak with Carmilla being written in Ireland, it was...
But more the folklore of that
story
that, inspired.
Well, I was going to say, yes. I know the inspired version, because also, she... made an appearance, they call her Bloody Mary in that version, but in Hellboy.
Oh, okay.
In the Hellboy, which makes sense. I mean, that tackles cryptids and supernatural things. And then, like, of course, I'm talking about Castlevania for one of our upcoming episodes, and she is, like, one of the main, not even just antagonists, but one of the main, like, characters for the half of the second season, all through the third season. But yeah, I knew a lot about vampire stuff and lore before this.
Yeah.
For the movie, I had never heard of Carmilla until I was gay on Tumblr in 2014. And I kept seeing that everyone kept talking about this web series that was, like, really popular and it had a vampire in it and it was gay. And I was just like, I don't know if I'm going to, like, watch this or not. And then I literally scrolled 9 to 10 years back on my Tumblr today to see if I could find the original post.
Oh, God, that is... dedication, dude.
But I had nothing to do over today. But I wasn't able to find it. But I know someone posted the link. I think the first 10 episodes of the first season of the web series were out. So someone, I think it was probably either Verge Girl or Kind of TV. I can't remember which one the YouTube channel was at the time. They had made, like, a playlist of the first 10 episodes. So I just watched it all then. Yeah, and then I've been kind of obsessed with Carmilla since 2014. So I think shortly after the first season came out, because I knew that the first season had been based on this novella, and then, like, the creator said mostly anything that mostly is referenced in the novella happens within the first season. There's a couple of characters that don't appear until the second season, but mostly they're like, if you read the novella now, you're not going to spoil yourself or anything in the web series if you haven't. So that was the first time I had read the novella, and I hadn't really heard of it before the series came out.
Yeah.
All right. So, to start with the history, which I guess we've kind of talked about a little bit, and Cal, are you going to do a more kind of general vampire history episode? Is that the plan?
Yeah, my plan is I'm going to try to combine...
Right, we are doing a vampire month. This is going to be the start of our weekly vampire month through April, because we got talking, probably be at the end of the KOTAR episode, about all these vampire things we wanted to cover, and then we realized we all have enough that we want to say that we thought we could just do a month dedicated to vampire stuff.
Right. So I plan on doing, I'm trying to decide if, so I'm going to read Interview with a Vampire, because I want you guys to watch that, because it's honestly really good.
The TV show?
Yes, the TV show. I'm going to read the book. I'm not going to make anyone else read the book, because I've heard it's an interesting read.
Yeah.
A little problematic, a little weird.
I'm focused on some weird areas.
Yes, but I also do kind of want... Maybe we'll finish the month. I'll do, like, a general... The vampire and queerness to finish off or something. Because I do want to do something with, like, Dracula and that story and how, like... I mean, fucking connect the whole, like, vampire queerness all the way through to, like, you know, stuff like... I mean, Interview with a Vampire is important in that. And then, like, all the way forward into like what we do in the shadows, mm-hmm. all the way to like Boulder's Gate, like pretty much anywhere like you can hit those.
What we do in the shadows has had an impact on like modern as much of an impact as Twilight on modern views on vampires.
Right. Yes, I agree. Yeah. So I don't know. I kind of would like to do a vampires in history with in the relationship.
Hey. So, and talking about that, Carmilla is kind of the origin of the lesbian vampire trope. But kind of general history of vampire, I didn't go too far into this. It dates back to ancient Greek, Mesopotamia, Hebrew cultures, all had kind of vampire-likeness. The word vampire first appeared in English in 1732 in reference to epidemics of vampires in Eastern Europe.
Really? That late?
Yeah.
I would have thought it would have been the 1500s or 1600s.
Yeah, I kind of would have thought that too. Okay. But it was kind of first popularized in fiction in 1819. In The Vampire by John William Pomodori, who had taken it from a story that Lord Byron told at that same party with the writing contents where Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. There's some other really popular story that came out of that as well. It's almost like every...
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Yes, I think so. I think there was all that...
same contest.
Yeah, that same writing contest. Like, all of our English... All, like, English language fiction goes back to this, like, one fucking party.
Is also the picture of Dorian Gray, or is it around?
No, that's way later.
Okay.
Yeah, but...
But, yeah, I know the...
Not way later, like, a few decades later, but...
But still, it was all from a lot...
Yeah, a lot of...
Single writing.
So, yeah, single writing contest. So, the vampire, this book, was kind of known as the first story that successfully fused all the disparate elements of vampirism into one coherent literary genre. So this is kind of the start of the vampire genre. So, Bram Stoker's Dracula is what really, like, skyrocketed that to popularity, but that was in 1897,
heavily influenced by Carmella.
Yes, because in 1872, Joseph Sheridan LaFanua, an Irish writer, wrote Carmilla, who was the first lesbian vampire. So the lesbian vampire kind of became a trope in kind of early Gothic horror in the 20th century. But in the Victorian era, it was more about kind of just demonizing sexual behavior, especially for women. And the vampires were usually like sexually transgressive, and then they were punished for that. So it was really kind of reinforcing straightness because being gay was being demonic.
Yeah.
Right.
I know, but you said something like about this, like, especially early in the book.
Like, even I was going to say just pre, like, this story, vampires, like he said, this is the first, like, you know,
not only the queer trope,
not even just the queer, just like the fuckable vampires, because before this, like,
right? How was the I, you know what? I haven't read The Vampire, so I'm not 100%.
I actually haven't either,
but I haven't. I know it's not like very famous. I feel like almost Carmilla is more famous than.
Yeah, I think it's mostly Carmilla and then Dracula. Are kind of like the two real ones. That was more. That one, it seemed pretty similar. It was more, I didn't really look that much into it.
But like, before those books came out, like, just the mythology of the vampire and everything, a lot of them were more, they looked more demonic and, like, they weren't, they didn't really talk. It was, oh God, here comes this shifting monster that will knock you out and suck your blood.
Yeah, right. I guess, like, not so much like quote unquote fuckable vampires, but the first time they were like a sexy, alluring figure was kind of Carmilla and then later Dracula.
Right. What we now think of as a vampire.
If you were going to say on the car ride here, we were going to talk about how, like I said, like it was kind of roomy.
Right. That it came off, like she came off pretty sexually aggressive at the beginning towards her. And like that, like you were saying, that it became a metaphor for like sexual deviation, especially like women's sexuality, especially with Carmilla.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that was very intentional, obviously, because they weren't promoting it, despite it being a pretty fun story for queer people. Clearly, this was a cautionary tale against such relationships.
Yeah, and also kind of, a lot of kind of Victorian horror was always, because if you notice in this with Laura, and then with, I can't remember if it's Nina or Lucy, or both in Dracula, a lot of the, like, victims or the point of view characters in, like, Victorian era horror are women. Because then men could read it and be like, well, I'm not scared. I'm scared for this woman I should be protecting. Because, like, them being scared would be, like, too unmanly. So, like, that wasn't a part of it. So that's why it's a lot of women in these, like, Victorian era horror stories.
Like, right around this time, you do have a lot of books, like, specifically coming out of Ireland. Because they just, I don't want to say just become more literate. But the British occupation had basically given them literary tools and such.
You mean so, it became more industrialized?
And more industrialized. A lot of the books around this time do have more British and more Europe, like other European style villains.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that he was Irish. I didn't know that because I would have assumed he was British.
Yeah,
no, at the time, a bunch of them were like, no, they look like an English person, and basing their monsters off of it.
Right, but you could also see why someone in, even though they were the victims, you know,
making them kind of hapless and dumb, so they're British.
Yes.
Okay, so Camilla first appeared as a CLI story in a literary magazine called The Dark Blue in late 1871 to 1872. It then appeared in A Glass Darkly, which is a collection of horror and mystery stories that J. Sheridan Lefanu wrote, which was presented as the posthumous papers of an occult detective named Dr. Helesius? The doctor at the start. So yes. Which also means that he is credited with the first lesbian vampire and the first occult detective in fiction. Huh. This is the, because that would have predated Jackie. But anyway, so yeah.
I was about to say, it's very interesting how much of this era of these books, this Victorian era, is so dependent on frame devices.
Yes.
Of I am someone telling the story, or I'm reading papers, or this is someone's found journal.
Yeah.
I think it's a very, it's kind of almost like a found film kind of way of writing horror, of like the Blair Witch Project almost.
Yeah,
like
I guess it was just like the trend at the time. But it is like very, a lot of these.
Because Frankenstein is like that too.
Yeah.
Which I hated. And I want to say first, and I do think I do need to give it another try, but I will say that I really liked this because it was everything I wanted from Frankenstein that Frankenstein wasn't.
Well, I feel like I know I have it here somewhere. Did you have to read Heart of Darkness in high school?
No.
Okay, see, I did, and it was because it was all, it wasn't really a framing device. The whole thing is basically someone is telling the story to someone else on a boat while they're like leaving, and I fucking hated it. I like barely finished it, and I was like looking back, I was like, I think I was just annoyed by that framing device, and now I think I'd be fine with it.
No, I hated Victor too much, which I think was probably
intentional. Yeah.
But he was just so whiny, and he just kept bitching about wanting to kiss his cousin, and it was so annoying. I was like, please stop. I hate you so much.
You gotta think about the fact that, like, I know we're supposed to be talking about the books, but, like, what they've done to, what those books and, like, stories did to film, like...
No, I wish I liked it more, because Mary Shelley is... like such a badass.
She fucked her boyfriend on her parents' grave.
Nope.
Oh no.
That was one of her girlfriends. Mary Shelley was queer, by the way.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Was Lord Byron.
I was gonna say that. I did know that. I was gonna say I feel like I knew that was like a beard kind of relationship. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
But because wasn't she like 18 or 16 when she wrote Frankenstein? She was like very young.
She wasn't very old at this party. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay. Pretty sure she was a teenager.
But, I love the different film just because like, specifically in the Frankenstein film, there's no lightning in the Frankenstein book. That was completely for film. And in the book, he's just like a weird, he looks exactly like Victor, just has like hauntingly yellow eyes.
Yeah, and he's just huge.
All the green and the neck bolts and everything were completely for film.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, we gotta get on.
Yes, I have 13 pages. So,
vampire, 13 pages.
Okay. So, I realized this late. But so I realized literally yesterday that there was a 2019 edition of Camilla that's edited by Carmen Maria Machado, who is a queer American author who's been a guest on You're Wrong About a couple of times. So I saw that she had an edition. I saw a photo of the cover where there is literally a pull quote supporting it by one of the creators of the web series. And I was like, well, what is this? Now I need to go get this.
So it's also a very cool cover.
So I drove to Barnes & Noble in the middle of the workday to buy this. And... so an insane plot twist to the history of Camilla. It might be based on a true story.
Really?
Yes. So in the introduction, Machado explains how in the 1970s, a researcher from the University of Iowa named Dr. Jane Light traveled to Lafanu's home in Ireland and found a collection of letters in his study. And these letters were between a half-English, half-Hungarian minor noblewoman named Victoria Housley, and an occult detective named Peter Fontenot. So Laura and the doctor, who's our framing device. And this edition doesn't include the letters, but it seems like they basically went through almost the plot of Carmilla when Veronica, so Laura, met a Spanish-Cuban aristocrat named Marcia Marin, who was sent to Europe by her father with a nursemaid and an eccentric governess.
So, 1970, do you mean 18?
No, this researcher found these letters in 1970.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, the letters were from, like, the 1860s.
Right, yeah.
So
100 years.
Yes, yeah. I think they were in a wall. They might have been, like, literally in a wall in his study.
That's kind of...
So, in through these letters, it seems like if this Veronica and Marcy were real people, that they were, like, literally, definitely fucking in love. One of the quotes from the introduction, from Machado wrote this in the introduction. Veronica wrote specifically of her own desire, not a mixture of attraction and repulsion that LaFanu repeats over and over. She did not speak of her fear of Camilla's return, but a profound desire for it. And it's not like metaphorical sex. There's like actual sex that they were having.
Right.
So I was kind of like blown when I was like reading this. I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So, and this kind of makes us like, even, I don't know. I always find this, the novelization. not that, we'll get to that in other adaptions. The novella, like, really sad based on, like, how it ends.
Yeah.
And this kind of makes it even sadder, because it seems like if these were real people, Marcia was just kind of a dramatic U-hauling lesbian, and all the men around her and Laura thought that she was some, like, demonic, so they killed her.
Yeah.
And
so this the real story ends in still her dying. It wasn't just like we heard the story and then someone wanted to fictionalize it into being like a monster because she stole her, you know, heterosexual innocence kind of thing.
This doctor wasn't a cult doctor, so I think it was like,
right. So they called in and said they're a demon and
yeah, they're doing something to my daughter.
Yes.
And basically the thing with
she
the general's
must be a succubus or something.
Yeah, the thing the general's daughter also still happened. She had stayed at a nearby house before, and then that girl killed her.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Wow, yeah, that sucks.
And if Veronica was a real person, she didn't die for any vampire-related reasons. She got married to her man shortly after this and died in childbirth.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was like, well, that sucks.
Yeah, that sucks.
So another quote from the introduction is, once Veronica's excised letters are restored to the record, the dimensions of the story become clearer. A young woman's sexual awakening and the senseless slaughter of her supposed defiler. So I was like, wow, this is why I like the adaptions of this more. So, yeah. Okay, so after that depressing twist, let's go to the plot summary.
Yeah, Jesus.
I was like, really? I was like, what the fuck? I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I've done that before when I've read introductions, and I've been like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I was like,
that also wouldn't be the first. Specifically with vampires turning a, like something that happened in a vampire story. In the 1840s, something there was basically a whole situation with like a guy's daughter getting tuberculosis, but they swore she was being taken over by a vampire, so they had to dig up his other dead daughters to see if her heart was still there. And that was actually the first, like, ever-printed word vampire used was in the newspaper to describe how they described
his that was daughter. How it initially got first appeared in English. It was translations of, like, stories like that were happening in Eastern Europe.
Right.
That one was in specifically in, I think it was, like, Maine in the 1840s.
No, you're thinking of a different one. I think I know what you're talking. I think you're mixing up two stories. I do remember there's stuff being about vampires in Maine and stuff around the time of, like around that, the Victorian times.
Yeah, when the daughter had tuberculosis.
Right, but tuberculosis was everywhere.
That's
tuberculosis
true.
Is still here.
Yeah. Not going away anytime soon.
Well, tuberculosis,
it's growing with us.
It's a bacteria.
Yeah. We've had it since the early days. Anyways, vampires.
Yes, okay, so to the plot summary. So, we start with the prologue with the doctor's paper saying that he collected this narrative from a young woman 8 years ago. No, 8 years after it happened, and that woman has since died. So I was going to start this by saying, like, so this woman is Laura. She's 19, and she lives in Styria, Austria with her dad. But then I realized they don't fucking tell us her name until the end of chapter 8.
Oh, yeah, I know. I kept being like,
when her dad
I don't know her name. And then they randomly said, and I was like, oh, I feel like they were like, oh, right. I never said her name.
Yeah, like her dad, like, says, like, is talking to Camilla and says Laura.
Yes.
Like, at one point, I was like, that's just very weird that I. Because I guess even the first time I read this was after the web series, so I knew,
so
like,
knew her name
what
Laura.
Her name was.
Yeah.
So, her and her dad are English, but they live in a castle in Austria with their two governesses, Madame Peridon and Mademoiselle de La Fontaine. And they're, like, rich and well off, but there isn't really a lot around. Laura tells us that General Spiersdorf lives about 20 miles away, and then there's a ruined village with a church and some tombs that belong to the now extinct Karstein family. She then tells us a story about when she was six, when she awoke during the night alone in a room and yelled for her governesses, but they didn't come. So she began crying and then saw, quote, a solemn but very pretty face looking at me from the side of the bed. It was that of a young lady. So this woman, Questra, laid down beside her and then held her as she fell asleep. She then awoke to, quote, the sensation as if two needles ran into my breast very deep at the same moment.
Can I say something about this?
Mm-hmm.
That it just brings up something cool about the mythology of the vampires is the location of the fangs have changed over time.
You mean where they bite?
Like, even in their mouth, where their fangs are, has changed over time. This would implicate that it's more like vampire bats, where it's literally the front two teeth you'd see, because the mark it leaves is so tiny.
No, they say later, remember when the guy comes and, like, He says her canines are too, that he needs to, okay, that she has unsightly canines. Well,
why would it only leave a single mark instead of two?
It doesn't.
Oh, it says two.
Two needles. Okay. Oh, when they find it, when they find it later, there is only one.
There's only one.
Right.
I would say, this is a little goofy because, like,
change over time, there's been one, two, sometimes it's right, like middle ones.
Yeah. She does say, she says breast here, she says breast later, but then when she's talking to that doctor, she says neck.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's.
Right, I'm thinking maybe we're talking
right.
Yeah, well, she said she has to put on the front of a dress to show it. So, like, right. I think. Okay, so this lady.
That's a way worse place for that. You have to go through so much muscle.
Yeah.
I hope you don't hit a lot of veins.
Well, I guess there aren't a lot of veins there.
We're just wider in Ireland. We didn't know a lot about anatomy, I guess.
Hey, so, you know, you have the four humors, okay?
But everyone knows if you slit someone's throat, there's a lot of blood.
That's true.
So, more than if you get a cut on your chest.
Trying to get at the good bile, okay?
So, this lady kind of pulls back once Laura screams. She then slips onto the floor and disappears. So, Laura yells again. Her governesses do come this time, but they don't see any puncture wounds and they don't find anyone in the room. They tell her that she must be dreaming, but she doesn't think that's true. She says that there's a lot of things she doesn't really remember about her childhood, but this was she remembers vividly because it was basically the most scared she has ever been of anything. So back when she's 19, she's walking around the castle grounds with her dad, who tells her that General Spiersdorf will not be coming to visit tomorrow as planned. Laura's upset about this because he was going to bring his niece Bertha, who is close in age to Laura, and she was hoping that they could become friends. And this, I haven't read the novella in like so long that I completely forgot this character was fucking named Bertha, because she's always Elizabeth or Betty in other adaptions. It just felt like a weird like Austrian holdover. So I was like, what the fuck, Bertha? What? anyway, so the Spielsdorfs aren't coming because from the letter from the general that he sent to Laura's dad, we learned that Bertha died of some illness. And there was a danger that the general overlooked at the time. He says that he will, quote, devote my remaining days to tracking and extinguishing a monster. And he'll probably be back in like 2 months. So Laura's sad, kind of in a selfish way about this. She didn't know, she never met Bertha. And she's kind of like, oh, she's died. But also, now I don't get to have a friend.
Yeah.
So right after Laura's father says, but I feel as if some great misfortune is hanging over us. A carriage speeds into view. They hear women screaming from inside. And then the carriage crashes into a lime tree in front of the castle, and Laura, her dad, and the governesses run up, find a well-dressed older woman who is kneeling over a pale young woman. I'm sure the book is, like, not supposed to be campy. Well, like,
but
not
this is so campy.
Yes. Not initially, but, like, coming to it from, like, this, like, horror comedy web series.
No, I was thinking that this was so goofy. This whole thing was so goofy. The carriage knocked over, her in, like, the ridiculous outfit, and then, like, Carmilla just laying there, like...
So, because they all went up, so, unprompted, this older woman says... so hopefully I can get through this entire quote because it's so long. So unprompted, the woman goes, who has ever been so born to calamity? Here I am on a journey of life and death, in prosecuting which to lose an hour is possibly to lose all. My child will not have recovered sufficiently to resume her route, so who can say how long? I must leave her. I cannot dare delay. How far, sir, can ye tell me is the nearest village? I must leave her there and shall not see my darling or even hear from Hill till my return 3 months hence.
Yeah.
No one asked. Nobody asked. So after she says all of that, Laura's like, oh, hey, a friend. So she asks her dad if the girl can stay with them, and he agrees. So the woman takes Laura's dad aside and talks to him about something, and then she whispers something to the girl, gets in the carriage, and leaves.
Yeah.
So, oh, and another edition from the Machado edition of this. She has a lot of footnotes kind of throughout.
Yeah.
And in this... Carmilla actually doesn't say mother like Laura and her dad do. She says Matska, which a scholar in 2014 pointed out is a word that means large cat in almost every language that would have been spoken in Styria at this time.
Huh.
So, okay. Also completely forgot until I was looking up stuff today. There is a character in the web series whose full name is Matska, but they just never call her that.
Huh.
It's in Austria. It's a region of
Norway. So like how Wallachia is what is the country where Dracula's from?
Transylvania.
Yeah, Wallachia turned into Transylvania.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, it was just a region of northern Austria.
That makes sense.
I think so.
I should know that.
Okay, so Gora Carmilla is taken by some servants to room in the castle, and Lorenz wants to see her, but she says she has to wait until the doctor sees her first. But her governesses have seen her, and Laura questions them, and they're both just like, yeah, she's real hot. Like, yeah, that's what we noticed about her. So they and
she looks so much better than my own daughter.
So they and Laura's dad kind of contrast this with the ugly hangdog fellows who were driving the carriage with her mom. Mm-hmm. And Laura speculates that, like, maybe the girl can tell them more about what happened tomorrow. But her dad explains that the girl's mom said that she's not to be questioned about her past or who she is because of her delicate health and nerves. So basically, the deal Laura's dad agreed to was just take my beautiful daughter, ask no questions, and I'll be back in 3 months.
Right, which is insane. Like, it's just so crazy. Like,
I mean, like, the thing of, like, this would have been, like, reading with a lot of this, like, all these things that feel, like, cliche and camp and dumb were all, like, originated in this novella. So it, like, wasn't at the time, but now it's just, like, this is so stupid. Like, obviously, this girl's a vampire.
Right. Like, I was going to say that. I wonder how, like, and maybe you talk about some. I wonder how, like, people reacted to this at the time of, like, not really having much of an ideal of, like, what a vampire, like, you know what I mean? Like, right, you had the vampire and you had folklore.
Yeah.
But there wasn't, like, this pop culture, general yes. knowledge ideal of vampires
yeah.
that has solidified and become, like, a trope.
Yeah.
That, like, I wonder what people thought, like, of this.
I really tried to find, like, reception at the time for, like, that reason and for, like, the.
But you couldn't find 2003 Baldur's Gate. German Baldur's Gate forums that had information.
I was on literally
the 1800s.
I was on Google Scholar. I read part of a translated undergraduate thesis paper from a university in Poland. Like, yeah. But I couldn't find anything about, like, what the actual reception was to it at the time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. So Laura finally gets to see Carmilla, and she realizes that she's the woman from the dream when she was six. And Carmilla tells Laura that basically she had that same dream where she did everything that Laura was describing, but she tells Laura that she was the age that she currently is. Because she says, your looks won me, and then she calls her a lady.
Yeah.
So Laura wants to stay with Carmilla while she sleeps, but Carmilla says she always sleeps with her door locked since her house was robbed when she was a kid. Carmilla says it's hard to part with her, and she thinks that they are going to be dear friends. Older Laura's narration then tells us, young people like and even love on impulse. I was flattered by the evident, though as yet undeserved, fondness she showed me. Oh, so then this is the thing we were starting to say that we didn't like last episode, where Laura's like, let me stop now and physically describe what Carmilla looks like. But it's funny because it's basically just like, yeah, she's really fucking hot and I like her hair yeah. and she's very pretty and her voice is nice. And it's like, okay. So,
yeah,
but
I want to say, I found hilariously at one point, I think it was somewhere around here, where Carmilla is, like, having one of her spells where she's not well, and they ask her, and then Laura at one point is like, are you well? Let me get you some wine.
Oh, like, yes.
Oh, yes, I feel much better now. I was like,
there was a lot of very goofy, like, 1800s.
Like, yeah. I think I might faint. Here, have some wine.
Oh, I think that's actually later after the funeral procession. But yes, like, right. Yeah, she gets yes. her, like, wine because she's worried she's going to faint.
That's so funny to me.
So.
There's some cocaine about it.
Yeah, basically.
Cocaine would at least make more sense than wine would.
Oh my God. You're getting ready to faint. Medics of cocaine, okay?
So, so despite, like, saying how beautiful she is over and over, Laura is, like, kind of annoyed that Carmilla won't tell her anything about herself. And all she really finds out is that she's from an ancient noble family and she lives west of Syria. But Carmilla's a lesbian and we met yesterday, but she tells Laura, like, in this first meeting when also, like, Laura's, like, sitting on her bed and it's, like, 2 a.m. or something, she's like, if your dark heart is wounded, then my wild heart bleeds with yours. And Laura's narration is kind of like, yeah, maybe this was, like, kind of a lot. And, like, maybe I should have been suspicious. But I kind of wasn't.
Yeah, it felt like the start of the,
yeah.
the grooming feeling.
Yeah, Laura's kind of...
Right, well, Carmilla's supposed to be manipulative.
Yeah, because she's, like, kissing her in the face and says, like, you're mine, you shall be mine, and you and I are one forever.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to mention something. I don't know too much about this topic in general, but from, like, a historian that does, like, YouTube videos, Kaz Rowe, who I really love, but one of them was talking... I can't remember which one he was talking about. I think it was, because I think I rewatched part of it because I wanted to mention some stuff in it of, like, about Dracula and how it was written and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, like, that, like, that was kind of a turning point in queerness and, like, being against queerness. But... that, like, before that, like, in this time, in this era, like, romantic friendships
mm-hmm.
between the same sex were not, like, were, like, encouraged, yeah. especially with women, because they would think that it would be, like, practice for when you got married. So as long as you ended up getting married, mm-hmm. it was okay if you kissed your friend, like, kind of thing. Oh, as long as you never had sex. But, like, well, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of why I was really trying to find kind of, like, reception at the time of being like, did people think this was, like, it's like, she's, like, I'm making a joke saying, like, she's clearly a fucking U-hauling lesbian. That's right. Why she's like, I'm in love with you, you're mine forever, we met yesterday. But, mm-hmm. like, it's also kind of, like, the grooming thing, too, of, like, she's, like, clearly is kind of manipulating Laura, being like, we just met, but I'm absolutely in love with you.
So but also, this where, like, the, in terms of, like, vampire powers of, like, another thing is, like, vampires have the charm effect.
Yeah, the seduction.
This also is probably the birth of...
I think this was probably the start of that, especially from, as you said, and I'm sure it's also a, don't worry, they're not, Laura's not actually a deviant mm-hmm. of, like, her whole, I was intrigued and attracted, but a little repulsed.
Yeah.
So I think, like, yeah, that, and I think that can come off as a, like, the vampire has this magical, seductive mm-hmm. allure kind of ideal. Like, but it could also...
I wasn't going to suck that dick, but, like, he made me by like, magic.
Well, that's kind of what it's like. She's so beautiful. What else was Laura supposed to do?
Right,
like, and
yes.
Almost every single person is just like, well, she's real fucking hot.
Right. But then, like, also them being, like, touchy or holding hands and stuff like that mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily at the time be seen as, like, yeah, I feel like some people would be like, wouldn't, this is like the 1800s, wouldn't the dad be like, this is a weird relationship going on?
Yeah. Well,
he gets there eventually,
but yes. It takes him a while to be
right.
like,
maybe
you
like
guys are a little kind too
of checked out as well.
Yeah.
Like, he's busy.
I'm going to pause because I want to have a conversation about that. Yeah, so do you, see, this is, I feel like I'm too influenced by the web series. So do you find your dad, like, you saying you feel like he's kind of checked out?
Not even, maybe not checked out, but like, granted, for the time, probably like, I'm busy with other things. My daughter can be my daughter is for her countesses and her nannies.
Yeah, I feel like I see him kind of just.
They didn't really raise their kids back then.
Well, yeah, and I just see him. I kind of view him just kind of being kind of hapless and dumb, and yeah. that he's just not really paying all that like close attention. Right. Oh, but not in like a neglectful way. He's just like not really.
Right. I don't think they didn't raise their kids back. She has like. What is it?
Rich people.
The rich.
Well, she has two,
she has two governesses.
Caretakers. Yes. So it's like, oh gosh.
Yeah, and there is some line, too, about how, like, there are all these servants and staff in the castle, too, but she just basically admits, like, yeah, they weren't really. Is it in this one? I've listened to so many different audiobooks from this. I know I listened to the original one of this yesterday, but, like, there are all these other servants and stuff around, too. They just don't really play into the story, so she doesn't really mention them all that
they're
much.
Not rich people.
No, yeah, I think don't they also mention a few times that like he's kind of like older and getting like slightly sick.
It seems like he's sick. I think at one point she does like I don't know if they say like invalid, but like
declining.
Yeah,
I heard the word invalid.
Yeah,
I feel like at one point they mentioned
so
he was close to or would be soon. Kind
which
of
also
idea.
Kind of makes sense for a rich person to marry a very young what like
right
having
probably had. The wife was probably very young.
Died in... Did you talk about her mother?
They
died
don't...
when she was an infant.
She died when she was an infant, and she was from Austria. So she was Austrian.
Because she was from the castle. She was like...
Yeah, she's a descendant of the Karsteins. Yeah.
I was going to say gross. Carmela's great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter.
Well, I don't think it's actually like... She's... We'll get into that when they mention it, because I like how Carmela kind of like, no, let's not talk about that part. It's like, I want to fuck you, don't. Well, throughout the time that Carmela's staying with him, Laura does start noticing all this weird behavior. She never comes downstairs until late in the day. She always drinks hot chocolate, but never really eats anything. She says at one point that, you know, she's an animated talker, but she always seems to be exhausted and has trouble walking for long distances. So this kind of comes up when they're walking around the grounds one day, and they sit under a tree because Carmela's exhausted. And this funeral procession goes by, and Laura says it's a peasant girl from the village who swore that she saw a ghost about 2 weeks ago, and she has been kind of dying ever since, and she must have passed away a couple of days ago. Carmela gets incredibly irritated by the funeral, the hymns, generally Laura being upset about death, and then she almost passes out. I think this is when Laura hands her some wine. and then she helps her inside. And then a little bit later, a fucking surprise hunchback. This never makes it into any of the adaptations, so I was like, what the fuck?
Like, yeah, some random traveling guy.
Yes.
Which I wonder if he was an inspiration for, like, what happens to Renville in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
No, because this guy is just, like, he's got...
He does a bunch of curios and, like, magic
items and shit. He comes up, he's some... Like, he basically has a bunch of magical items.
Is he some, like, I kind of assume... lamp? I thought they said something that he was, like, a traveler.
Yeah, he's basically, like, a traveling salesman, basically. So he has all these kind of weird trinkets, including charms that can ward off monsters.
He whips out his trench coat. He's like, hey, look, you guys want to buy...
I want to buy a sundial. Yeah.
You want to buy a charm?
Yeah, so he's the one what Cal was saying earlier, like, points out that Carmilla's got, like, really sharp teeth, and he can, like, file that down and help her with it. Mm-hmm. So she gets, like, incredibly pissed at him. I mean, I guess the purpose of the Hunchback does continue into other adaptions. This is basically just to show that Carmilla can go from, like, being incredibly timid to incredibly, like, violent.
This is really unrelated, but I'm going to keep laughing about it until I say it.
Yes?
So I also want to preface this with that, like, I was in late middle school at, like, the height of, like, Twilight kind of things and vampire stuff. But I had a girl in my, class, kind of near my friend group, that swore that when she went with the dentist, they had to file down her canines because they were too sharp. And I just thought, definitely to be, like, aren't I cool and, like, kind of vampire in, like, this goth group of, like... Sorry, I just thought of that and I had to mention
it. Okay, I don't want to bring too much into from the web series because we are going to be doing an episode about the first season. But this just kind of reminds me, it was just this very...
Every morning we rip out our teeth.
When the episode where Carmilla bites Laura for the first time. Like, that ends with that, like, her having bitten her. But then in the next episode, just the way it started, it's like the way Laura gets off the bed, and she's got, like, really long hair, and it's in a ponytail, and it's covering one of the bite marks. So it just looks like there's one giant bite. So people all do this fan art of Carmilla with one giant fang in the front of her teeth, and it was like, Carmilla the Vampire. It was, like, the dumbest fan art that was all over the place for the longest. And then, like, even the creator's like, yeah, we didn't really think about it when she, like, flipped her hair over her shoulder like that, that it was going to look like that. So,
sorry, I just, like, I thought of that and I could not, like, get past it. Because it was that exact, like, middle school boasting about something so stupid that was probably obviously a lie.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So, Laura's dad is called a doctor for Carmilla because of that earlier fainting spell.
I don't mean to laugh, it's just reminded me of the freaking vampire episode of South Park versus the goth kids.
Literally, that's literally what I was in, like, that kind of group, like, the vampire group.
Oh my
group.
God.
Like, that's literally who my, like...
Oh yeah, I literally remember watching that episode of South Park with that, and you said...
Yeah.
To butters to the Hot Topic.
Mm-hmm. So, so the doctor has come to see Carmilla because of this fainting spell. But Laura sees her dad and the doctor leaving Carmilla's room, kind of laughing and talking about, like, fantastical things. She didn't really know what to make of that at the time. So that evening, a messenger arrives with a bunch of old paintings from Laura's mother's side of the family that had been sent off for cleaning. So Laura finds one that looks exactly like Carmilla and says it's Macala Countess Karnstein. And Laura asks her dad if she can hang it in a room.
Normal.
Because gay. And he says yes.
It looks just like Carmilla.
Yeah,
I do. I want it right by my bed for normal reasons.
For non-gay reasons. So they all kind of start having a little conversation about the Karnsteins. This is where Laura says that her mother is a descendant of them. And Carmilla says that she thinks she might be a distant relative or something. Right. It doesn't matter. We don't have to talk about it. So...
Oh, yeah, I heard some cousin or something. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Whatever. So Carmilla quickly gets them outside so she can have this conversation with Laura about, like, hey, so you have to have that painting of me in your room. That was cool. And then she basically tells Laura that she loves her and that she has only ever been in love with her. And this is when she kisses her for the first time. Is it even somewhere, too, where I think Laura's, like, trying to figure out, like, what this is because she keeps... I think this is when she has, like, a very, like, a brief moment when she's like, oh, I wonder if she's actually, like, a disguised boy. Like, I've heard stories of that happening before. And then she's like, no, she's too feminine. That can't be true.
Let me see, because I know that I put different things in my, like, I highlighted different stuff here to, like, but yeah, I do remember what you're talking about where she is like, I'm confused, like.
Yeah, it's basically Laura trying to justify because, even if we're talking about, like, this being, like, the romantic friendship era, she's almost kind of being like, this is getting a little too intense.
Right.
Like, which almost her thinking, like, well, it's got to be some other thing. Like, you must be in love with someone else, and you're just, like, saying those feelings, like, to me. There has to be some, like, boy, right. You know, right? And, which is, like, I guess in this version, it's very, like, there's a lot of other adaptions that I've read where it does kind of do more of it, like, being kind of blatant internalized homophobia on Laura's part. This one is kind of just like a, I don't know, am I gay? Is this a spooky vampire?
Right.
But, yeah. So after kissing her, Camilla tells her, I live in you, I would die, I live in you and you would die for me. I love you so. And Laura's kind of startled by this, but then Camilla nearly faints and then they go back inside. I think it's like later the same night, Camilla is saying that she's thinking about leaving because Laura and her dad have been too kind and maybe she'll just stay in the village until her mother gets back. So they basically, like, both Laura and her dad basically both kind of freak out and be like, no, that's impossible. You must stay with us until your mom gets back. So up in Camilla's room, Laura asks her if she'll ever truly confide in her. And she says that she can't tell her who she truly is, but she starts telling her about this ball she attended many years ago. And this is kind of when Laura starts piecing together, being like, you're talking about this stuff like it was a really long time ago.
You can't be much older than me. When did you go to these balls?
Yeah, and she's also like, and Carmela said that she was like very sickly through one point of her childhood too. So she's like, when were you this sick, but then also attending these balls? Like, this timeline doesn't make sense. So, a little bit, but she's so hot, so Laura doesn't really care.
Yeah. Okay, whatever.
So, Camilla does say that at this ball, she was wounded in the chest and she never fully recovered. Laura asks if she was near dying, and Camilla says, yes, very, a cruel love, a strange love that would have taken my life. Love will have its sacrifices, no sacrifice without blood. I just needed to say love will have its sacrifices. That's what the theme song of the web series is called. Yes. And that's very prominent throughout the web series. So Laura goes to her room and she locks her door to go to bed because she started... Camilla's basically got her spooked, like, oh god, what if a robber comes? Right. So she's been locking her door at night as well. So she has a dream about a monstrous black cat on the floor that comes towards her. It jumps onto the bed. She feels the pain of two needles, wakes up screaming, sees a female figure standing at the foot of her bed, but then it seems to teleport to the door and then disappears from the room.
I will say that I do, like, even, like, obviously, like, knowing what Camilla is, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I will say that, like, the little dream sequences, they were spooky. Like, they were fun. I liked them a lot.
Yeah.
Like, they were creepy.
Yeah.
I liked the way they were described. Also, I liked the I don't know how intentional it was, but I'm sure it probably was not, like, knowing what it was. But the fact that, like, they wrote it like ghost stories that are most very likely sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, like... knowing, like, they didn't know, I'm sure they didn't know what sleep paralysis was, or that it would cause hallucinations or things like that.
Sleep paralysis demon is actually a demon.
Right. But
the
so,
reason
like, they
you couldn't move when that succubus entered the room is because magic.
Right. So, like, I'm sure that's why they were writing it like that, of like, oh, we've heard these stories of how demons are, and people will be familiar with these stories.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did like that. Like, in a way, it almost went back around to being like, oh, this could. I can almost disregard this, knowing that
you're saying people
what's
got
being explained.
Cool sleep paralysis demon and Marika only got shadow peeing.
Did it one time?
No, I've gotten lots of crazy sleep paralysis demons. I thought it was a sleep paralysis demon. It was actually my cat fucking pissing on my face, and that happened twice.
I thought there's another time where you thought she was peeing on your face and she wasn't.
No, most of the times when it feels like something's peeing on my face, she was peeing on my face.
I've had crazy nightmares.
Oh, I
I've had the waking up screaming nightmares, but I've never had sleep paralysis.
Oh, I have sleep paralysis.
The opposite of sleep paralysis. I've got the thing where you do stuff and don't remember it.
Right.
So, keeping that footnote in mind, though, from the 2019 edition, maybe this giant black cat isn't Carmilla.
Right.
And maybe it's actually your mom, which means that the most scary kind of violent thing that ever happened to Laura actually wasn't Carmilla. It was her mom. And
the dad actually in real life, the dad got a leopard's daughter.
Yeah,
there's a randomly, leopard somewhere. Yeah,
yeah, he just randomly, you know, he just bought Shadow. It's just Shadow.
It's my
That's
cat.
Literally
my cat
what the cat. Yeah, instead of peeing, she just bit that time.
So
the Maine Coon with the brain cell.
Mm-hmm.
Laura's terrified, obviously, by this, but she doesn't tell anyone at breakfast the next.
Also, because doesn't it kind of line up with the stories that the like peasant girls have been saying before they died. Yeah.
They all saw like a ghost, or they saw like they had these like nightmares and stuff.
Yes,
so yeah. So she's worried that maybe she has.
And she doesn't want to worry people
yes.
that she's going to get
did
ill.
Did they have the name of the peasant disease yet, or is that further in the book?
I don't think they called it anything.
They don't call it anything.
I thought they said it was an umpire. I thought they said they had come down with umpire or something.
One of the end with like 17 random characters just appear. One of them might have said that.
At this point, I think they're like, oh, they all came down with Umpir. Or that's what they're calling it. And then later on, the guy's like, no.
I do remember something about
it. I remember a lot of I listened to it earlier today, and it was like, Ben mentioned Umpir a lot when you were talking about the disease.
Yeah, so, Down Breakfast.
They're talking about when the doctor comes and he's like, yo, I think like this is a problem here.
No, that's when he said the V word. This was before all that.
No, I mean the first time when he comes
in. Oh, yeah, when he comes the first time.
Because he doesn't call it a vampire to her yet.
No.
Like when she first, you know, before they start going to the village and the general arrives, but they're like starting, but it's clear the doctors, that's what the doctor
thought at this point.
Down at breakfast, Madame Perdon and Mademoiselle de La Fontaine. I got really annoyed writing this in my notes so many times because in these characters equivalent in the web series where they hang out together a lot, you can just call them Laugh and Perry, which is so much fucking easier. And so I was like, yeah, but Madame Peridon, Mademoiselle de La Fontaine, are making kind of all of this worse by they're talking about how they think that lime tree in front of the house, which is also right outside of the bedroom Carmilla is staying in, is haunted. And I was like, please stop talking about this. Carmilla's going to get too freaked out.
Yeah.
So Carmilla then comes down, but it's later than usual. And she basically tells Laura that basically the same thing with that giant black creature happened to her as well. But it stopped when she touched the charm to one of monsters that she bought from the surprise hunchback.
Mm-hmm.
And then she starts getting really intense about Laura keeping that charm with her at all times, too. And Laura thought it was just basically used to like put it in a random vase in the drawing room. So she's like, okay, I'll get it and I'll keep it with me now because like Carmilla's being like so intense about it. So Laura starts getting sicker, but she's not telling anyone. Saying that like sometimes she's fine, but other times she feels like she's a changed person. Says, quote, a strange melancholy was stealing over me, a melancholy that I would not have interrupted. Dim thoughts of death began to open. The idea that I was slowly sinking took gentle and somehow not unwelcome possession of me. If it was sad, the tone of mind which it induced was also sweet. Whatever it might be, my soul acquiesced in it. So for about 3 weeks, she keeps having all these strange dreams and she's getting even sicker. She doesn't think it's what killed the other girls because they were only sick for a few days before they died. And Carmilla is complaining of like similar but not as bad symptoms. And then one night this happens. So Laura's asleep in her bed. She hears a voice say, your mother warns you to beware of assassins. And at the time, a light unexpectedly sprung up and I saw Carmilla standing near the foot of the bed in a white nightdress bathed from chin to her feet in one giant stain of blood.
See, like, this was creepy. Yeah. I liked this. This was creepy.
Yeah. So, Laura wakes up, like, freaked the fuck out. So she's been locking her doors well, too. So she starts screaming. The governesses are like, what the fuck's happening? So then she gets to the door and she's like, fuck, we gotta go to Carmilla's room. So they have to break into Carmilla's room, but then she's gone. So every part of the castle and the grounds are searched, but nobody can find Carmilla anywhere. And around the time where her dad and some of the like groundsmen are talking about like dragging the river, because they think that like, Carmilla must be dead and maybe her body's been thrown in the river, Laura's like filled with this agony. So she walks up into Carmilla's room and just kind of stands there. And then Carmilla is also like, then she sees that Carmilla is also standing there. And she said that she woke up on her dressing room couch and she doesn't know how she got there and she doesn't have any idea what happened. So Laura's dad is seeming like pretty freaked out by this, but he basically justifies it with like a really bad sleepwalking excuse. Of like,
hey, that's actually a really good sleepwalking.
Yeah. Yeah, but like it was that she like sleepwalked, she unlocked the door, she took the key, she wandered somewhere else. They searched literally in the entire fucking castle. They could. It seems like he's kind of like, yeah.
I feel like that's a lot more logical, you know, explanation honestly, than you're a vampire.
It sounds like when I said I do the opposite of sleep process, that's the kind of shit I can do.
Brett's brother one time sleptwalked and peed in the fridge and then, like,
no sleptwalked
and woke up outside or some shit. You do crazy shit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's like, remember Dad woke up, like, on his... No, he didn't even wake up.
Yeah,
he was Grandma like, found him in his underwear on their back porch.
Yeah, like, yeah. So, like, people do crazy... And they'll do...
Cal says I can have full conversations.
Or, like, sometimes people have done things like cook in their sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Done very well. So, taking out a key, relocking it, that is
that crazy.
I was like, no, that actually, I was like, why, before he said it, I was like, why hasn't someone said that she sleptwalked? I feel like that's what explanation.
Okay, so did you guys not think this of the thing that you thought Lois' dad was trying to
do? Oh, I think she was lying, but I think her dad was like, no, obviously. That's kind of a reasonable explanation.
So I think it's both, because I think it's very much, in an interesting way, I think it's very much the dad in all horror movies. Oh, that goes, no, there's no ghost. It's just blah, blah, blah. We're going to stay here in this haunted house. Obviously,
he's Fred from Scooby-Doo.
Right, like
the dad like, from the first Conjuring movie.
Yes, like it's that trope, or like where the dad is like, "No, no, no, nothing's going on. Everything's fine. I'm not gonna believe it's ghosts."
Yeah,
you know. So I feel like, interestingly, it does make sense, especially in this context.
Yeah,
you know. But I think it also kind of almost starts that trope of like,
yeah, hapless dad. hapless
dad who doesn't want to believe any of the, you know, the supernatural stuff that's clearly starting to go on around them. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like it makes somewhat sense.
No, that deer always had human hands, Brandon. Right. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
So the next day, Laura's dad does call a doctor, but he hadn't told her that he was going to do this. So she explains her symptoms and the puncture wounds to the doctor and Madame Perrodon, who's also there. The doctor doesn't really tell her anything and makes Madame Perrodon swear to not leave her alone for any reason.
I know it's the 1800s, but God, this pissed me off.
Oh, yeah.
Of like the medical professional evaluating her, being like, no, it's okay, sweetie, to the adult woman, and then telling the dad what happened and saying, we got to keep it a secret.
Oh, telling the two adult women, because he doesn't tell Madame Perrodon either. He's just right. Like, you have to keep an eye on her. Right. They're not told. He then goes off to a different corner of the room to tell her dad about it.
Yes,
so
it's just like, yeah. Medically, it really pissed me off.
Yeah,
really,
I mean, we do have I feel like there's a lot of the, like, patriarchy and homophobic element of, like, normal Victorian era, like, literature.
And the very, infantilization of young women.
Yeah.
Very much that they keep treating her like a child. It keeps kind of annoying me, where I'm like, why isn't anyone just, like, talking to her?
Yeah.
But I do feel like she isn't written as bad as a woman written by a Victorian man could be.
Yes, yeah.
I do feel like she does have some agency and, like, thoughts. I mean, very little.
Her agency's about to drop off a whole fucking lot when she isn't going to take part in the climax.
Right.
But
I do think it could have been somewhat, it could have been worse.
Well, I think that's because she's narrating, so a lot of I think it's because she's doing first-person narration. We're kind of getting a lot of kind of her perspective on things. So, so the doctor then leaves, and a man arrives with a letter that says that General Spiersdorf is going to be visiting soon. Laura's dad then says that he wants to go up to the ruined church and the tombs of the Karstein family to see a priest that lives there and wants Laura and Madame Perrodon to accompany him. And Laura says that maybe, you know, Camilla and... I didn't even bother writing out Mademoiselle de La Fontaine here. I just have La Fontaine. can follow them so that Camilla can see the village too, because she's never seen it before. Because this is the point where, like, this is really where I feel like Laura just starts kind of dropping off as a character. Because, like, even there, it's like...
She's just listening to this to the plot that's happening.
Yeah, and she doesn't really seem to comment of, like, if she's suspicious of Camilla or if she's, like, real defensive that everyone seems to start being suspicious of Camilla. I guess it was, like, a little bit later, but, like...
Right, there could have been more of her being... Because there are, like, a few of where... When, like, because the general arrives, right? That's what's...
Yeah, we're about to... On the way to the village is when we meet up with the general. Yeah, Lord has commented that he looks a bit, like, older and tired. And then he proceeds to then tell them what happened to Bertha. And that lasts about 3.5 years. So...
Yes. So, like... And, like, here there are a few, like, in between. But, again, the whole idea of, like, a framing device. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like now no one would ever write a narrative story where they just have two people tell each other, or, like, someone tell a story to another person in the story.
Yes.
Just in dialogue. Like, that's crazy.
Well, this is what one of the, it's an Audible original adaption of Carmela that I did. So, in this part, it actually switches from Laura's narration to the general's narration, to Bertha's narration, back to the general narrating it, back to Laura narrating it.
Right.
So, like, it really does work, because it's, like, then suddenly the person is telling their own story, and it's not just being, like, told third hand to Laura.
Right.
Or, like, Laura's telling us what someone had told her, but it's really the general talking about what happened to Bertha. So it's, like...
Right, because that's how someone would write it, the story now.
Yes.
Or they would write it as the two stories concurrent, doing flashbacks versus time periods, of, like, as Laura's story is developing... We're seeing Bertha start to go wrong and something being weird.
Or even if we would do the same thing, the general's like, let me tell you about what happened to my ward, and then it would be a flashback.
Yes. So I find this very interesting. But we do have a few cut moments where Laura is like, oh my God, that's what's happening with Kermit. So we do have a few, but yes, definitely she's not like, wait, that sounds like
No one seems to be like,
every so often,
this sounds like the girl that's coming with us is going to meet us here.
Every so often, her dad's like, carry on about that, General.
And it's yes. Like, and okay. It's like, why isn't anyone being like, this is Carmilla? Like, clearly, we're all thinking it at the same yes. time.
So, the General starts this whole very long explanation. Says that him and Bertha went to a mass ball held by Grand Duke Charles, and Bertha began talking to a young woman named Malarca, who was wearing a mask. The girl's mother, who was also masked, began talking to the General, and he made it seem like they knew each other. And then also coming from a footnote from the 2019 edition, in the letters, one of the mysterious details that this woman gave to the General to try to convince him that they knew each other is that she says she knows about Kurt. Kurt was apparently a man that he had an affair with while he was serving in the military almost the entire time. Which makes it seem more like actual blackmail than, like, spooky trickery. So, I was like, huh.
Interesting.
And that's really interesting. We can have all this other, this all very female homophobic shit, because that's not gay. But, I said that.
Female romance.
Romance, yeah, that's not gay, but we can't mention men at all, because then that's
like
gay.
How the queen of literally is like, no, being gay is illegal. We're not going to talk about lesbians because I'll just get...
Exactly. Yeah, that was always kind of the
ideal. That was slightly a myth, but...
Well, I mean the attitude, though, of like...
Yes, yes. It was... Yeah, that was it. It was Queen Victoria. It was in Victorian...
Of course it was. She's the one who had the weird dick throne.
In Victorian... I don't know enough about that. I only know about gay things. But whatever, so... Anyway, so... Well, that was the era that it was illegal for her to be a gay man
there
in England.
There were sodomy laws, yeah.
Yes,
much.
But there was nothing about women because...
Because they didn't think they knew how to have sex. They
well, the
to.
Myth was that Victoria didn't believe that lesbians existed. So that was why it was never allowed. But it was more just like no one ever really thought about it. So, and also no one's offended by it because whatever, that's hot. Like,
right.
But it's
or
gross.
Not only is that hot, like, she's not ruined. Her, she still has her hymen.
As long as she gets married, she's not. You know, and that was exactly like kind of the whole thing with the romantic friendship things. Is no one gave two shits as long as eventually you were expected to get married or you know eventually
Achilles
something
and Patroclus. You guys are getting too old to share a tent,
right? Like that. But that whole kind of everything with that of right. Well, that's a whole different story. But like,
hey, they can get married now.
Yes, I know. I was like, oh, finally.
Did you see that? And everyone was like, all gays should get a birthright trip to Greece now.
I always thought they were like, oh, good, nothing gay has ever been happening in Greece before. And it was the one vase of like a gay threesome. I mean, like,
I saw it with the joke of, remember the episode of Futurama where Leela pretends to be a man and Zap Brannigan's like, why am I so attracted to this man? And he makes a joke about, hey, I've been reading this book on ancient Romans.
Yes. So the General is overseeing, oversees that Macaulay is being pretty,
that is interesting, though, that he likely, which was very common, as always,
in serving in the army, he had a sexual war.
Right. Had a sexual
relationship
with
another man. Also, like, this is
man.
Not his daughter, it's his niece.
Right.
So, like, but he calls her his daughter and says, like, he says
right,
so
that's
someone
true.
Here.
He's never married.
He says that, and someone here to Laura's dad, of like, I know you would understand my play by being a single father that I never married. Had this.
His roommate, John.
Exactly, right. Yes, yeah.
I was even thinking of that, of like,
He loved her so much, he built two houses to contain their love, and they never slept in the same bed because that was a sin.
It's, yeah, I mean, I just think it's interesting, though, that there is the possibility of this also being all a guise of patriarchy.
Yeah, like, all just...
Going against, even though you're doing the same thing, but patriarchally, you have more power, so you shutting it down in a violent way to secure yourself and your own safety with the heteronormative society.
Yeah, so, so the General is watching... Oh, God, what are we talking about now? Malarca, being flirty with Bertha, and she eventually removes her mask, and the General and Bertha are like, oh, fuck, she's really hot.
Yeah.
So, the General was trying to get the mother to remove her mask so we can figure out who she is, but they were interrupted by a stranger wearing all black, and this guy has a conversation with the mother, and then she comes back and says that she has to leave.
Oh, and she's also playing this coy little game of, like, oh, I know you. I'm an old friend of yours. Don't you remember me?
Yes.
To him. Which I find her a really interesting character that, like, never gets resolved. Right? Yeah, like, what is she doing? Who is she? Where did she end up? Like, mm-hmm. I think that that's very interesting of, like, her character. And she has, like, this whole group of, like, seemingly monstrous or
possibly all vampire guys, like, yeah, like,
right,
hanging around with her. Yeah, so...
And so what was her relationship to Carmella?
Like, yeah.
Was it a romantic, a sexual? Was mm-hmm. it a parental? Was it a pseudo-parental?
I was just saying, is it that they just switch who's the mom every once in a while?
Well, no, so she does appear older, but if you're both immortals...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, like, so one person is, like, what, 40, well, and the other's, like, 20.
That's how I always kind of had earlier.
They do seem to also have the shapeshift.
Right. So is the Black Cat her? Does Carmilla also have some shapeshifting powers? Because she was able to disappear that one night.
Mm-hmm.
Like when she was a kid, so I find the her very interesting.
Well, I mean, like, vampires were also one of the three like main monsters throughout all of, like, mythology and everything. It's ghosts, vampires, and werewolves, because of course it is.
Right, but yeah, so
yeah, I'm not going to say anything more about who the older woman is because I don't want to spoil anything from the web series.
Okay, I'm going to guess that they address those kind of mm-hmm. unanswered points. But yeah, that is it, because I find her
very interesting. Well, yeah, because we don't know what happens to her. Like, at the end of it, she never came back. Like,
right.
Yeah, so basically after this guy who seems like he's probably one of those hangdog fellows, so probably one of the vampires, mm-hmm. Comes up to her and says that she has to go.
But it is also interesting that the men seem to be described as ugly.
Yes.
Or, like, grotesque.
No man has been described as attractive in this story. Have you noticed that?
Also, I think... Yes, but I also think it's very
funny. But it's, like, Loy's dad and, like, a bunch of old doctors or, like, barons.
Hey,
and
then the hunchback could maybe have, like, a horse cock. We don't know. But they didn't get into it.
Well, Loy and Carmilla were not interested. So. Yeah,
right. But I do also think it's interesting, though, because we have it with Bertha, too, where, like, everyone around them just assumes that, like, young women are going to be swayed by other young women's beauty.
Yes.
Which is very interesting, because I feel like in this time, or how it's written, it's like, people in this story assume that all women are attracted to beauty in the way that, and I'm sure it's mostly because straight men have written it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they can't have the, all they can think of is like, of course, women would also think this very beautiful woman is beautiful.
But that's what's the interesting thing about this.
But it makes it like default them into everyone being lesbians.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of the same thing of like, that's what Dracula's appeal is too, is that he's like incredibly, he's incredibly attractive and has this charming thing. But like, but then it's just like, it's Mina and Lucy who are attracted to him. And
but here, Bram Stoker was also likely gay.
Oh, well, probably. Oh, well, okay,
he was close friends with Oscar Wilde, and he kind of wrote it as a response after the trial. It's all about the Oscar Wilde trial and his
which is why I want to talk about.
Isn't Oscar Wilde from...
Read the Cosmo, no, or watch the Cosmo thing about Bram Stoker. It's so interesting. But, yeah, it seems that, like, he had multiple men that he was in very close romantic friendships with.
Okay.
Like, never married, and then, like, pretty much spiraled after the Oscar Wilde trial, and then wrote Dracula right after that.
Okay, so we're saying here Bram Stoker, Mary Shelley, Oscar Wilde. Like, why is anyone like, no, we can't tell the kids that gays exist? It might destroy society. Even, and it's like, our entire society is based off a gay shit. The ancient Greece.
Even the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde story is literally about, like, doing coke.
Well,
it's a coke bender. And then, like, also, like...
Let's also be honest. It lets him
engage in his Victorian era, like, Mr. Hyde does all the bad things. So Dr. Jekyll can be, like, this pure, good person. But it doesn't specify what the bad things are, so very big kinds. It could be like he showed his elbows too. Like, yeah, he's having full on gay sex in the church.
Well, that's what I mean. Is all these monsters, all this horror, especially when you think about how many people were either queer or in close relation to the queer people, like queer people at the time.
Or if like there was just more exposure, like they'd be like, yeah, we really love each other. What do we do? I mean, obviously people have figured it out forever, but you're, you know, a 19-year-old Victorian girl and England / Austria, like, maybe you don't know what you're supposed to do. So you just be like, yeah, we hold hands and kiss each other. And then, like, but, you know, maybe if you had read Carmilla, then you would know, like, oh, we could fuck.
An interesting thing in general, and now that I'm thinking about it, is queer people and, like, their affinity to both right and
the arts
and
in general.
Not just the arts in general, and, like, consume specifically horror. Like, you know, if we're thinking... Mary Shelley, if we're thinking, you know, Bram Stoker, or if we're just thinking the way people now can, especially monsters.
Or a fringe culture.
Right, it's a fringe culture. It's usually somewhat, like, depraved. Yeah. Especially early on, I'm sure you could see more queer representation because people could die.
Literally the
So
aliens,
you could just kill off easily.
Literally the aliens in Alien are designed to be as phallic as possible to inspire fear.
Well, there's, like, so many... Well, I mean, Scream was written by a gay man.
Yep.
Like, all this stuff. Like, so much horror. And also, there's a huge thing of just the horror gays. Yeah. Like, that's a huge, like, the Scream Queen kind of.
I used to watch, like, when I would hang out with my gay friends, we just watch B horror films
all
the time.
Well, gay people love horror films. There's, I don't know, there's something interesting about that in general. Sorry, I got sidetracked.
Okay.
But yes, I think it's very interesting.
All right. So, so this guy basically comes up to the mother, like, takes her aside for a second to talk to her. And then she says that she's been called on this really important quest that she has to go on, but she's going to come to the General's Castle in about 3 weeks to visit him. But she's really worried about traveling with Malarca because she was recently injured in a hunting accident and she hasn't fully recovered from that yet. And around the same time, Bertha and Malarca walk up to the General and Bertha asks if Malarca can stay with them because it seems like her mom's about to go on this really important journey. So the General's kind of like, well, fuck. Okay, I guess she can stay with us. So then the mother leaves. They all join the party. They lose Malarca for a little bit because she just seems to wander off. They're all freaking out like,
oh, shit, I just said I was going to take care of this, like, 18-year-old, and I've lost her already.
And this guy, yeah, and the General's like, fuck, I don't even know what her family name is. How the fuck am I even supposed to find
her?
So they eventually find her, though. They're all reunited. She says she wandered off, got exhausted, and she fell asleep on, like, a couch in a hallway somewhere.
She does that a lot, apparently.
Yeah, it's totally normal. So
she's like, I just need some more wine. I'll be good to go. I'm ready to rally. Let's give me some more shots. Let's do some shots. I'm ready to go.
Just refill this chalice for some Merlot and I'll be fine in a second.
She just went to throw up in the bathroom for a second. Now she's like,
I'm back.
Leaving.
So.
Who's ordering shots?
So they bring her back to their castle, but they start noticing some weird things. Like, she doesn't get up until really late in the day and she seems to be sleepwalking and Bertha's getting sick. So, as Kel was saying, not as much as you really would have hoped, but everyone kind of starts having a little bit of like a, oh shit, this sounds a whole lot like Camilla. And maybe did we just switch the letters around? I'm just doing a joke, I'm serious, but...
Anagrams. I just thought, just go ahead.
I mean, that was like a thing of the time of this would have been like, that was one thing I've actually seen of this was being like the first time like people had really done like, ooh, spooky anagram things. But, like, it's so dumb. It's so dumb. I love it. Like, this is one of those camp elements, like, coming from the web series, because I think they, like, they specifically make a joke. They're like, what the fuck? Has nobody ever heard of an anagram?
I remember, I was like, I was doing something recently, and I was so pissed about stupid anagrams, I can't remember what it was. And now I remember, it was during the fucking Revan books. There are two different times Revan uses different anagrams for Revan. Two different times in that book. And someone is like, the second time someone is like, you think we wouldn't notice that? No, it was the first time. One of the Mandalorians were like, you think we wouldn't notice that, like, you're a random Jedi here and, like, you know where the mask is and your name is just jumbled Revan? Obviously, you're Revan.
So...
but that just reminded me.
So this is like a very long, like, it's literally like a 3-chapter long explanation that the General
didn't hate this.
What?
I didn't hate this.
I
felt like it kind of built the suspense. I liked kind of hearing the backstory. I liked the party. I don't know. I kind of was vibing with it.
I think you might understand.
But I came straight from a no.
Yes, and yes. I feel like you might understand my part of this, because this kind of splits, I don't remember exactly what episode it is, kind of basically this whole, there's a specific episode in the web series that kind of covers this part, like, of the General telling this story kind of in, like, a different way, but it's a web series that has, like, fucking 6 characters in it. So, like, right. Lore and Camilla are very central to all of that, and it's, like, there's a lot of very good, so, like, this is basically where we kind of have the biggest main divergence from the web series.
The first time you heard the story.
Yes. So this is kind of, when the General starts telling the story, we kind of, like, we kind of diverge somewhere here from, like, the web series goes one way, the novel goes the other way.
Right.
So I think that's why I'm kind of just, like, I'm not really, Because even like I read this part and then I had to re-listened to the audiobook that's on YouTube. I re-listened to that one. Oh, well, it was also the Audible one I sent you guys. That was the same
I
one.
I listened to that one.
Okay.
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, so like I had to re-listen to it because I was just like, I feel like I just like kind of like a yada, 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 yeah, yeah, I know how this ends.
Right.
But like it's not really the most interesting because we kind of dropped off our actual...
I do think we had a little bit of interest to it. Of like what I was saying is that I wanted Laura to say more. But yeah. I do also get like, I don't know, maybe reading it in first person and hearing these two like men talk about this and her already be in the dark about what's going on with her. That like there did seem to be this like putting yourself in her shoes of reading it in first person. That like,
yeah.
I do feel like there was this mounting sense of like fear and like build up here.
Yeah.
Where like, she start like maybe it's just me like you know projecting on her of being like being able to like think of like oh my god she must have been sitting there like the fuck.
I mean it does kind of work well of like they're basically ignoring her.
Right. So and, you have to so I guess in my own I guess it would have been nice to have some of that internal monologue written mm-hmm. down more. But in my own mind I was like she must be going insane. She must be like it's Carmilla.
Yeah. I mean
have I been bitten by a vampire? Like you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah. And she, I feel like it's probably the most like, we've seen one of the adaptions, it's called Camilla and Laura. I can't remember what it was from. But it's more like a retelling of this. It's just a little bit longer. But in that one, throughout while this is happening, we do get that from Laura.
Right.
And I feel like that was the most like audiobook I had listened to. And in that one, I was like really actually feeling, I was also in the middle of a 20-mile run because I was training for a marathon. So maybe it was just like I was half dying and like, oh, I'm so invested. Like, that one I was more like, oh, I'm actually like scared. For, like, you, Laura, having to, like, experience what I know is coming. So, like, I feel like that one was really good. But yeah, I mean, this does kind of work a little bit, probably unintentional on Jay Sheridan LaFondue's part of, like, it's the patriarchy because, like, Laura's just being so ignored by all these men. And they're not really telling her anything, so she doesn't know anything. So she's sitting there in this carriage. She is experiencing all of this. But nobody asks her what she thinks. And though she's the narrator, she doesn't even get to tell us.
Like, right. And despite her, like, being... you know, pushed to the side, I'm, you know, whatever. We have clearly understood that she is a competent adult human.
Yes.
So, like, you know, like, she even has suspicion about, like, she asks what the doctor told her dad, and, like, he just kind of shuts her down. Yeah. Stuff like that. So we do know that she's, like, not so oblivious that she literally doesn't even notice that stuff's going...
Yes.
So I do feel like that's where I got, like, this kind of start of, like, impending doom that I felt like she was feeling
yeah
at this time. So I did feel like the suspense was building to like that and like knowing what was going to be happening. And of course I knew what was going to be happening just because I know it's a vampire book.
Yes. Yeah. Right? How do you think this is gonna end? Yeah. So we go to the Karnstein tomb because that was Malarka's family's last name was Karnstein. We were then told by a woodsman that we went into there had been some like we've also been told that this village is like fully abandoned. Commissioned multiple times that none of the buildings have roofs. I guess that was just
weird. They might have rotted out.
I guess they rotted out. Yeah, I felt like that just felt like a very old timey way to say like the village is abandoned. None of the buildings have roofs. And I was like, yeah, because I guess maybe they would have been like wood at the time,
or, so like,
they
just probably collapsed.
Yeah. So he basically says like,
oh, go real quick.
There was all this vampire activity in the area, and that's why like nobody's really been around here. Laura started mentioning that she's feeling, like, weaker, like, the closer they're getting to the village. Though she's also been on this, like, really long carriage journey. And so they were told, well, this woman basically says that, like, yeah, he is pretty sure that Countess Karstein was a vampire, but some nobleman from Moldova reportedly, like, removed the tomb and the body of the Countess, and now the location of it's unknown.
Is this where we get the really horrible Rachel? Who is, it's not the groundsman, it's not him, I think it's, like, the other person that they come and get. But they, like, say this whole thing about, like, that he was, like, oh, that he had, like, ugly brown skin or something. There's something there where, like, we have a weird... Did no one else notice
that? Is that here?
It's one of the characters. Like, do you know what I'm talking about, though?
No.
Oh, let me see. Okay.
Well, they say weird things about her mom that... Or, like, the mom. That, like, looks like she has, like, a turban on, and there's some, like, weird racial thing, which they might not that have been looking more into this. They might bring that into the web series a little bit. But, of her not being white, not, like, the racism. It's from 2014 in Canada.
Oh, my God, she's Romani.
Well, that's what I thought might have been with the hunchback guy. That I thought he might honestly, have been, like, the traveler
kind of
guy.
He would. You didn't listen to an audiobook?
Yes.
Did you listen to an audiobook?
Did
they do the weird, like, Italian, like, have a stereotype thing?
No. I listened to on Audible. She just did a straight voice the entire time.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. No, they did not do the Wampa, rawr, rawr.
Well, the other one I listened to, it was like, they just made him Italian, but they made
some comments about Italians in this story, too.
Yeah, the one they made the
I gotta find it, because I remember it being pretty jarring and being like, okay, what are we saying?
Okay, well, while you keep looking, I'm gonna keep talking about, because we just kind of hang around the same thing here.
Time either.
So, the general had a doctor come and visit Bertha, and he gave him a letter that he said that he should only open in the presence of a clergyman. But he kind of thought that was stupid advice, so he didn't take it. So we opened it anyway, and the letter said that Bertha had been attacked by a vampire. So that night, the general hides in her room and witnesses a large black cat attack her, which then transforms into Mercalla. He attacks Mercalla. He attacks her with a sword, but Mercalla just disappears, and then Bertha was dead by the morning. So Laura, her dad, and the general reach the tomb. Then, literally out of nowhere, Baron Vordenburg arrives. Which there might have been, like, maybe one line of, like, the general saying he was, like, trying to meet some researcher he had, like, learned about on his travels. And this, this is where, like, I really kind of, like, but this all seems so silly, but it is really close to also how Dracula ends. So, like, maybe this is just how books went at the time. We're able to open up the tomb. We're able to find the tomb of Countess Mercalla. But Camilla arrives. So basically there's like a stone, like, sarcophagus, like, bust thing of her. And they're all just like, and Laura's dad's like, it's Camilla. And the general's like, it's Malak. And nobody lets Laura speak. So then Camilla arrives shortly after. And so they realize, like, oh my God, she's Malaka and Mercalla and Camilla. Da-da. She kind of like makes eyes at Laura being like, and Laura's even like, yeah, she had some like weird, like kind of goofy, like half smile thing. But then the general sees her and tries to attack her with the woodsman's axe because the woodman returned. I guess he came to the tomb too. Whatever. So Camilla disarms the general and then she basically fucking vanishes. Yeah. And then this is the point where Laura's literally sent home for the rest of the story. So they pick up this priest that the general was supposed to open up the letter in front of, and Laura's dad initially said he was going there. So, because they, you know, they trust him now and think it's a good idea. So they pick him up and they all return home. This is a lot of, like,
I cannot find it, but I swear that there was something where they, like, talked about, like, one of the people here in, like, the main guy at the end in the conclusion, where, like, they talked about him having, like, dark skin and, like, being grotesque or something like that.
That's kind of how they described the Baron when he comes
in. Maybe it was the Baron. Yeah, it was the Baron. They said the Baron was, like...
Yeah, and I was
Yeah, they kind of say, they call him like a shriveled old man at some point or something. So back at the castle, basically, like, the general, Laura's dad, and the Baron are all kind of, like, discussing. Oh, I guess, no.
I can't find it. So.
And the,
maybe
I don't know. Anyway, all the fucking men are discussing Laura's illness, but she's kind of pushed off to the side with Madame Paradon. And Camilla isn't back at the castle, which Laura thought she was going to be. And she's kind of really disappointed that she's not there. And, like, Laura's father's, like, keeps talking with all the other men, and he's definitely, like, explaining what's going on. But he makes both Madame Paradon and Mademoiselle de La Fontaine sleep with Laura in her room that night, which he finds, like, a bit too cautious, because he, like, kind of really doesn't understand what the worry or the danger is. Which, I don't know, doesn't really seem, like, I feel like, I don't know. I don't know if it feels like it's a bit like a, I don't know if, like, Tay Sheridan LaFondue was trying to say it's, like, a naivety on Laura's part, or if she's trying to be like, well, I know Camilla's not gonna hurt me, so, like, what are we all so worried about? Like, but Camilla never comes back. And so, like, obviously Laura's really upset about this, but she does start getting better. And then the older Laura narration tells us that, you know, you, the reader, probably heard about the myths of vampires from parts of Eastern Europe. And she wouldn't believe that it was real either, but this was what she witnessed, and she doesn't know any sort of explanation for what happened to her. So she doesn't really get to take part in the rest of the story. Have you found the...
No. Jesus, but I swear to God, do you guys not remember that, like, there's be someone describing someone as, like, dark and ugly or, like...
I think the Baron's wearing, like, dark clothing and has, like, dark glasses. I don't know if they're specifically...
No, there was something about, like, their face was dark or something like that, like their skin, or
it might have been that they had like a darkened face, but I didn't think that from this era. It was more just like,
the way it was said, I was like, oh. And I thought there was something about hair as well, which is why I was like, but I'm not sure. I can't remember
anything about it.
I could be mixing it up with some other old book I read that is also
very possible. I mean, I feel like that feels like the description of the mom. They have her being like a weird dark figure or something.
No, it was later. It was like in the graveyard kind of area, I thought, when we were talking to the huntsman or something.
Mm, okay.
Or like the guy who's I don't know.
Okay. You're good.
So yeah, so Lloyd didn't get to take part in the end of the book, but there was a government inquiry written about what had happened. So she read that account, and so what she tells us that what happens from here on out is what she read from that. Which is also like her dad didn't fucking tell her what happened. Like,
yeah.
Like, cool, Laura's dad. Who is named Sherman in the web series? He's not given a name. So basically the day after they all got home from the initial like encounter at the tomb, Laura's dad, the general, and a medical examiner, I guess I'm probably the Baron, go back to Camilla's tomb and they open it. And the 2019 version has some illustrations in it. And so they say that her eyes are open, she's breathing, and there was life in her body despite her being dead for almost 150 years. Also, her coffin is filled with blood and her body is floating in it.
Yes, yes, she's like,
Detail they don't include in that description, but is included in this illustration. Yeah, in this illustration, Camilla's just fucking nude. And I was like, fuck, that's sad, that's not sad. I was like, okay. Illustrator choice that we made there. So basically they drive a stake through her heart. She does some crazy screech, dies. They then cut her head off, burn the body, and throw it into the river. And Laura just isn't here for any of this. She just tells us that this happened.
Don't forget, it screeches too.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it screams.
Yeah. But Laura's not here for any of this, which is like, okay. So she then tells us that she learned a bit more about vampires from Baron Vordenburg. He is a descendant of that Moldovan nobleman who helped with the Karnstein like area of vampires, because that guy was also a Baron Vordenburg, and he was either in love with Countess Karnstein or he was like pursuing her, but she died possibly by suicide. This Baron doesn't really know. And apparently death by suicide opens up corpses to tampering with vampires. That's not really explained any further beyond that.
I was going to say, that's interesting to me that, like, what they decided was what caused the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And this book was kind of, like, suicide and, like, the grief.
Yeah.
And, like, feelings about suicide is what caused, like, I don't know. I liked it. I thought it was kind of interesting in like, a poetic way to decide that, like, someone lived on, that, like, if there was too much grief and sadness with a suicide, that like they wouldn't die, like they wouldn't be fully dead, and they would still be there to like leak onto the living, like
the unfinished business trope,
right? But I feel like it's almost done in a more interesting way, that is, it's like both evil but also like sad.
Yes, because it's basically, so it, because it kind of gets onto that, like with this Baron thought in like some way that was like kind of like his fault,
right?
So he comes, he helps with the area of vampires, and he basically, like, hides her tomb so that no one ever finds it, because it was, like, still a common thing, as the current Baron tells us, to basically, like, defile the corpses of people who thought were vampires.
Right.
And he didn't want that to happen.
Kind of like how back then they were afraid of people dying, like, you know, cages around.
Yes,
coffins.
Right, from the body snatchers.
Well, not even just the body snatchers, zombies.
Or the rising from the
right, but what that really comes from is body snatchers.
Oh yeah, yeah,
the
cages
and all that stuff. That's all just that they didn't want.
Well, they also didn't really check bodies back then, so sometimes they would bury someone alive.
But the vast majority of it was just body snatchers.
Oh yeah, we went to a very fun live show for podcast Stuff You Missed in History class. That was, it was like around Halloween. It was all about like
the bell system and everything.
Yes, yeah, the phenomenons of like the like
with one of like my weird internet
things about versus you know, like getting buried alive.
Yeah, I do want to say, like, I actually highlighted a quote from kind of
concrete
around this this part of the book earlier actually, but where I think the Baron is saying that in these cases it seems to yearn for something like sympathy and consent. In ordinary ones, it goes direct to its object, overpowers with violence, and strangles and exhausts often at a single feast. So, but talking about like how the vampire feeds.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I thought that it was interesting also with the ideal of like vampirism definitely being a metaphor for like sexual behavior, that like sometimes it's about like wanting to make a relationship and everything, but other times it just consumes, it just devours and it doesn't care.
Yes, I mean, that quote kind of...
They got to raise their, 7,000 with their 7 sources so they can raise to be an ascended vampire.
ignoring what he just said and talking
about... It was a Baldur's Gate joke.
Yeah, I was going to say, talking about lesbian shit. But that kind of goes into the thing where Lua keeps asking Carmilla, like, well, haven't you loved before? And she's like, no, I've never loved it. I've only ever loved you. Uh-huh. Which is into being like, everyone else died in a couple of days, but not Laura. Laura continued on with Carmilla being there for, seems like almost maybe 2 months.
Right.
Because it's like she actually was in love with her.
Yeah.
So she didn't, like...
And it also seems like, at least partially, Carmilla wasn't feeding on her the whole time.
Yeah.
Right, because she was going after the peasant girls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was only until slightly later that she started having the nightmares of... And also, they started with the cat before she saw Carmilla. Yeah. So, was it that the mom or whatever was like, no, you need to get this one. You need to target this one or I'm going to.
Mm-hmm.
So then Carmilla tried to do it to lessen it. Or, so there's this ideal of like, how much was Carmilla in control or wanted to actually have a relationship with Laura?
She only do a little bit.
Is the ideal that she was actually like wanted a relationship or cared for her? Because she even says, you'll be mine for death and after, which makes it seem like, oh, right, doesn't she say something?
Oh, you'll be mine in death and forever or something.
Right, so it made it almost seem like she wanted her to become a vampire with her.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. I find the whole idea of, especially if we're talking that this, it seems kind of likely that this was based off of a story of, like, actually two women in love at this time.
Yes.
You could even see more of it being, like, this idea that Carmilla didn't want to kill Laura, but instead wanted to be with Laura and wanted Laura to be with her, but shit just got crazy or something.
Yeah. And then the book kind of ends after the Baron kind of explains all that. Laura tells us that they were never vampires in Styria again. Her father took on a tour of Italy for a year to recover, but she never really fully did. And the book ends with Laura saying, it was long before the terror of recent events subsided. And to this hour, the image of Carmilla returns to memory with ambiguous alterations. Sometimes a playful, languid, beautiful girl. Sometimes a weathering fiend I saw in the ruined church. And often from a revere I have started fancying I hear the light step of Carmilla at the drawing room door.
Yeah, I actually highlighted that exact last quote too, because I love it. I think it is so great. Like, I don't know. I
find it so horribly sad.
Yes, it is. It's so sad. It's so sad. But I think it's a great way to end the book, of this ideal that, like, right, because if she does, we decide that she dies like 8 years. Right? She had since died before the 8 years passed.
She says sometimes when she's... I guess we don't know.
Doesn't the doctor say that she has since died?
The doctor is... Okay, so Laura was writing about the events 8 years after they happened. By the time he's writing this note in his...
She has
in his papers, she has since died.
So we don't know exactly how old
We don't know exactly how old she
was. Yeah, but I don't know. I like the last quote because I like the idea that it's kind of... I mean, I think it's kind of a good idea of... I feel like in a lot of ways it can just be seen as like a weird whirlwind romance. That like you could say the same thing about like some random fling you had for a summer or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes I remember this beautiful memory where they're fun and cool, and other times I remember where they weren't great. And sometimes I still think I hear them and that they're still with me or like this whole thing. And it's really tragic, especially like, you know, that Carmilla died, that Laura didn't have a say in it, despite it. And I think there's also something to say that she was the victim of this, but the men decided what was happening.
Yes.
That they took all control over it, that they killed her without any explanation, even though clearly something was going different with Laura and Carmilla versus Camilla's other
with Bertha or the other peasant girls and stuff. So, I mean, that's the thing of, like, what you're saying, it does feel a little bit like this whirlwind romance, but, like, maybe Carmilla was never going to kill anyone else again. Maybe, like, she would have just stayed with Laura. But all these men decided that, like, no, you can't exist like this. Which is, they're saying you can't exist as a vampire or you can't exist as a lesbian. Regardless, you have to die for this. And we have decided you, the more sexually explicit one, are the one we're going to blame for this. Well, not our innocent little girl. Like,
Who just was too overwhelmed by your beauty. And she just can't control herself.
Yeah.
Right, like, I think that was kind of what I was saying about queer people writing and also so enjoying horror, of this ideal of like monsters and like this whole ideal of like that kind of thing. And I think it's always, especially in this era, and I think honestly, I think forever actually, that so many of monsters have to deal with like things humans don't want to look at or think about. Mm-hmm. So in Victorian era, that was, you know, people who were outside of like the sexual or romantic norm. Mm-hmm. And like all the way forward into like stuff now. And then the vampire became more of a sympathetic character later on. Mm-hmm. When you get to stuff like, which I will talk about, which was kind of the, surprisingly, was actually the first book from the vampire's perspective, was Interview with the Vampire. So like, and that was in the 70s, mid 70s.
Oh, weird.
So that was the first time where the vampire was the main character, where the vampires were the ones we were talking about. We weren't talking about their tragic victims anymore. But it was the vampire who was the interesting character at this point.
Weird that that took so long.
Yes, it is. It is. But that's like, at least from what I saw, I did only preliminary research into this because just the whole story around Interview with the Vampire is so fucking interesting and weird. That was kind of the first time it was brought into it, which was not meant to initially be a queer allegory, but actually an allegory towards grief that then became a queer allegory. So I don't know. I just like, I find it interesting that like these horror elements are always intertwined with queerness going forward. And like even shit, like even goofy shit, like, you know,
Carmilla's army of lesbians in the Castlevania games.
Right.
Well, that, like, not so much in the games, but in the show.
In the show, yes.
Her, it's a, it's an alliance of the four all-female vampires who are doing a shit ton better than all the male vampires.
Or What We Do in the Shadows.
Or What We Do in the Shadows. Nadja is by far the most competent of the...
Right, that, but also, like, I think that could be something at some point, too. It's the interesting way that they were able to write a compelling and engaging, straight-presenting queer, non-monogamous relationship in that show that you find yourself rooting for and enjoying.
The first episode, they both talk about how they each fucked the Baron.
Right. They started it from the beginning a little bit as a joke, and then they had some bad plots, like with the Jeff thing. But they clearly realized what people liked about them was them being open about their sexuality and still being together and supporting each other.
Yeah.
And they built on that and went with that. And like their whole thing about the queerness of those vampires in that series is that, like, if you've been alive for 1,000 years, why the fuck would you care about anything?
Exactly.
Like, you're gonna fuck the one episode where Guillermo comes out, he's like, I'm gay, and they're like, yeah, we're all gay. And he's like, yeah. And Laszlo literally says, everyone's gay. He's like, everyone's not gay. He's like, really? We all are.
Right. Like, that's what I mean, is it's, I feel like that's an interesting way to talk about the sexuality with monsters and vampires.
Just even mortality in general. Like, why would you be stuck inside a stupid little binary?
Right.
Or expectations if, like, hey, I've been living for several thousand years. Why am I only attracted to this?
Or if you're Camilla.
Yeah.
Who, you know, if we're saying that Camilla was probably, you know, alive as a vampire for a few hundred years from the picture we saw.
She was made a vampire in 1698.
Right. Okay. So about 200 years.
Yeah.
So you would say that in that time, maybe when she was raised as like a human, she was told to be straight or whatever. And maybe she engaged in that or didn't. But at some point she realized, I'm a fucking immortal being that kills people. Why the hell should I not just have sex with who I want to have sex with?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What vampire wouldn't do that? You already have more power in the world. You
can just
kill
people. Why the fuck does it matter? You can just kill
people. Why would you? And also, you're now outside of human society.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you try to
fit
in with human society?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like vampires and monsters and queerness. And I think it's very cool.
Yeah.
The way that they interconnect.
I like things that aren't even on the gender binary. So.
Yeah, I think Carmilla's cool. Right, what I was saying with, like, sorry, I'm just talking.
No, that's fine, that's fine. I was like, whatever you said. I was just excited that you even liked
the novella. No,
I feel like
it was good.
Yeah, I feel. See, I feel like I have a lot of gripes with it, but it's because I came from the web series to, like, first. I went through the web series to get to it. So I feel like, from that perspective, it was like, oh, this is a fun, that this is, like, what this show that I really like is based on, but like the show is like, I really love the show, and the fact that like it ends like it does.
Reading the Iliad after reading Song of Achilles.
Yes.
Oh,
it's
I'm
like
sure.
Like, I'm looking. Where are we talking? Where's Patroclus?
playing the games of Castlevania after watching the show, it's like,
Where's the drama?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
oh, cool, I get to explore a castle. Where are we going to talk about that cool-ass monster boy?
Yeah, so, I mean, that was kind of like, I was like, oh, well, this is, I guess this is fun. Like, this is nice. But, like, it's more just, but it ends so sadly that it's kind of just like, yeah,
I'm
but really.
But this was also in the, I mean.
No, understandably. Like, I wasn't expecting it to end in, like, any positive way. Like, I knew what the story was going into it. But it was just like, I think that's why I like the web series so much and why I like some of these very goofy adaptions so much more, because I was just like, well, yeah, that's kind of what I wanted. Like, right. Or it's like, that's what I know the story to be. So, like, the fact that, like, you know, I don't like that we end, like, you know, Camilla gets murdered by a bunch of fucking men and Laura isn't even there to witness it. Like,
right.
And
I do think, though, something I think is interesting about the ending that I think. Well, because first of all, this is interesting in general because of how explicitly queer it is, despite the fact that, you know, we killed her at the end. Because that's well, I don't know how shit worked in books. I think
I don't know if there was
more...
ever an officially like a like what you're talking about is the Hays Code, which was like the old Hollywood thing that if you had anyone be queer or do something sexually deviant, they
had
one
to
of them had to die at the end. So it does kind of follow a Hays Code principle of like, well, they...
Or the queer villain.
I was going to say they have to be the villain.
Or the queer villain, yes. So like they're either the villain or they die or both. So like,
right.
But this does follow along with that, but which means seems like this is so much earlier than like Hollywood, because that was like the 30s.
Right.
So this is kind of like, yeah, this is just how you wrote it like that. But it does kind of feel like, it kind of going in, I was like, oh, well this, yeah, obviously it's going to have like a Hays Code-esque ending. We can't let them...
Be together,
or be happy, because like that would be completely
promoting it.
Yes,
and what we're trying, and of course, I don't think the author was pro lesbian.
Right? No, but
like it is like, but what I mean is from the ending is I think that they could have made Laura just be like, "I'm so happy that evil creature is dead. I am now married to a man and so happy." You know, they could have done that. But I do like how they ended it of this whole, like, I still can't stop thinking about her. And I still never know if I'm going to be thinking, like, about this, you know, beautiful, funny woman I loved or this monster everyone told me she was. But sometimes I still just feel like I feel
I just
want to
see her
house.
Again. Yeah.
Yes. So I do feel like they don't just totally write off Laura's relationship to her. Because I feel like they could have been meaner.
Yes.
At the end, where she could have been like, hell yeah, fuck yeah, she's dead. I'm
well,
so happy,
I mean,
I'm
if,
free
if
from
we're
her
saying based on those letters that
were
found in the 70s, we don't mention, it's not mentioned that Laura eventually married a man and died in childbirth. We just told she died. And
right.
then, and like, she...
Right, exactly, they don't even mention that.
And so that's like, Jay Sheridan LaFanu doesn't even mention that. And like, and she... Like, you know, we...
I'm curious about him now. I'm interested in why he wanted to hide those letters. Why he...
I think it was...
But also why he made the book that he wrote off of it not as anti-gay as it could have been.
I mean,
the letters even real? Was it... Because he wrote multiple framing devices in his fiction.
Yes.
Was this him almost LARPing?
Yeah,
I mean... You know what I mean? Writing it
maybe
himself?
Maybe he did...
I mean, maybe he wrote it in letters... Well...
And maybe that was the original story he wanted to tell.
Was in the form of letters.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because, like, it's not the version we had. Like, I know this came out before Bram Stoker's Dracula, but the original version of that, it is written in newspaper clippings and journal entries and letters to track, like, the events of what happens, rather than, like, a straightforward story like this. So maybe as a literary device, he had written all the letters and said, no, this is bad. But rather than burning him, he's like, I still like
right,
this.
As a way
of,
like, pre-write.
Well, they do say when they found the group of letters, like, bundled in that wall, or when that doctor that in the 70s found them, it was, like, the letters were bundled with basically the prologue written out in Jay Sheridan LaFanu's handwriting.
Okay.
But not the... not the part of the original manuscript that's, like, in some, like, literary library in Ireland. It was a different piece of paper that he had just written it out, and he had bundled it with those letters.
So it is possible he wrote the letters as, like...
Well, they said that this was in his handwriting. It didn't say the letters were.
So,
and also, like, the letters, like, it didn't say...
So it seems like maybe he received the letters...
He got the letter somehow, yeah.
And wanted to write some story based on it where he wrote the prologue. Maybe and then he had to...
So that no one would accuse him of being...
Yeah, that was a thing Creepypasta, because it was saying, like... Because it seems like the letters, or, like, Veronica's letters does seem to kind of have the same kind of voice as Laura does throughout this. So it's kind of like, maybe he's...
Maybe he didn't want to hide it. The plagiarism.
Yeah. Of, like, plagiarism off of just some random woman in Hungary who was dead.
Yeah, I just find that super interesting.
That fucking blew my mind. I knew nothing about that. And that I was like, what?
Because that opens the door to so many... Because even then in this... Did you say he was involved in that early horror writing or no?
No, he was not.
But was he involved in any of those circles? Did he know them? Like,
No, because he must have lived much later. Because the vampire that was written by that guy was at the party with Lord Byron and Mary Shelley. That was in 1819. This came out in 1872.
But what I mean is, like, I wouldn't put it past some people in these horror writing groups to almost do something like writing role-play fan fiction. So I could also see this being some friends that
the vampire started. I don't really know what the premise is, but, like, it was just a story Lord Byron was also just telling at this party while it was all happening. And, like... Yeah, so they were just all, like, because they were basically all day where they were all in some, like, crazy, like, manor house. They were all fucking drunk off their asses being like, hey, you know
what? And they were playing D&D.
Yeah, and they're like,
Victorian D&D.
Yeah, like, you know what's... I think it was, like, it was super late at night.
Check out my OC. It's a dead guy.
Yeah. They were all, like, everyone split off and think of the scariest story you can think of. Yeah. And then they all came back and presented
it. And no one presented late-stage capitalism.
But there is an argument that you could even say that he had friends that he wrote the prologue for. Like, let's say, this is a pure speculation theory here, but you could argue that, how real are these letters versus what I mean? But he could have written a prologue, especially if he's in the horror writing
genre, which we've already established,
has some queer people in it.
Yes.
Closeted or not, you know. And could have written the prologue and then given it to people to write letters. To, like, do that as a prompt, almost.
Well, it was that the originally, you know what I mean? The one letter, she didn't sign them Veronica, she signed them V. But it was this researcher in the 70s was able to track down that's who V was. Then it just says, according to Dr. Leith, Carmilla was in fact Marcia Maron. But nothing of, like, how she figured out who that was.
Right. I just think it's an interesting... Right, like, was this...
Well, it seems that... But it seems Veronica Helsa was a weird person. So maybe it was like... So maybe they were just like, oh, let's attach it to this real person who was, like, a minor noble woman at the time. Maybe not, but, like...
I mean, regardless of if it was their own writing experience fun bullshit, or if it was an actual account, like, it is still fucking super interesting and also super fucking sad.
No, I was, like, getting, like...
The story of...
Reading that, and then I was, like, flipping through this, mostly just, like, looking at the footnotes, and I was like, shit, this... We can contextualize this the entire fucking thing. I was like, this is really fucking sad if it's, like... It was just these two fucking lesbians. I mean, that's how I view it now. And I feel like I'm coming to this because I'm coming to this wanting to protect the little baby actresses who played them in the web series. Not little baby. I mean, they were, like, basically the same age as me at the time when they were playing them. But, like, they're supposed to be younger. But I was like... So I feel like I'm always very protective for Carmilla because of the way they are portrayed in the web series. It's, like, it's so cute. I love them so much.
Right.
Like, and I feel like anytime I, like, read this and this, it kind of feels... Based on the way I've come to it, like, it almost feels like we're doing a Victoria era AU of the web series.
Yeah. Oh, wait, what were you saying?
But you said you had something to say.
I said I had more shit to say. So you were talking about how you were, like, fucking, like, the way you feel about it being, oh my god.
Okay.
An AU, a Victorian AU.
what it was. So I feel like the novella is, like, a Victorian AU of the web series, which... they do kind of play off of it because the Carmilla, the web series, which we are doing an episode about, I know I'm talking about it more than I was intending to. It basically got three and a half seasons and then a movie. And in the movie, three and a half
that's
seasons.
That's a community joke.
I know. It got 3.5 seasons and a movie. But in the movie, they basically have them go to, like, a Victorian manor house. And they, so basically everyone in the cast gets to be dressed up like they're in the Victorian era, which is kind of like this very fun thing of like, okay, this is like, we're gonna do an homage to like, we're technically a story from the Victorian era. So like now we're all in fun dresses, like in suits for some of the other characters. Right. But like, so I feel like that's how I always feel about it. So I'm like, I'm not that much attached to like, to, I guess, this story, because like, I love the web series so goddamn much.
Right. Yes. I get that. Like, I did, honestly, this is probably a book I will read, like, in October. Like, honestly, this book I liked so much as, like, a horror book.
I'm really surprised.
Like, one day when I have, like, honestly, I could see myself being a weird, weird gay dad who reads my kids spooky Halloween stories in October when they're, like, 10 years old. And this would be a book where I feel like would be spooky enough and not be terrifying.
Yeah,
it's not too scary.
Yeah.
Yes. So, like, that kind of thing. Like, and I think that's because I've always wanted to like being like, you know, like I said, this kind of vampire scene goth kid, always wanting to like gothic horror. And the first one I read was Frankenstein, and I hated it so much that it turned me off to it, that I never actually read Dracula or Camilla because of that.
Yes.
So like now have like reading Camilla, I was like, hell yeah, I love this. So now I'm going to read Dracula, especially for the stuff I want to talk about later.
In high school, it was.
But you were never a big reader like I was.
No, no.
Because like, Frankenstein was, I don't want to go off on a huge rant. But like,
no, I would like to like it, but like I've never tried, and I've only ever heard. I didn't have to read in high school, but I heard from everyone who did that like they didn't like it.
Yeah. It was an option between that and like something else, but I was like, you know what? I want to do Frankenstein. I think it might have been Dracula, but I picked Frankenstein because I wanted to be slightly outside of my, like, I was like, oh, I like vampires. Let me do Frankenstein because I'm not too familiar with this. Right? And, like, I remember that, like, all throughout school, there was only one book I never finished, and that was fucking Huckleberry Finn. The only book I never finished because I hated that. Frankenstein, I was very close to not finishing, but I was like, it's going to get better. It's got to get better. It's got to get... So I suffered
through... That was
through
my views on Heart of Darkness.
The whole thing, and I hated it the entire time. I was so pissed that I never ended up liking it, which maybe it was intentional.
You said I wasn't a big reader. No, I actually did read Dracula because I was, it was, you know what, I wanted to do so I can do it. It's just, like I said, it reads as newspapers and journals. So it's like, this happened and this happened. Cut. New date entry. This happened. Then this happened. It's like, okay, I'm tired of reading.
Well, that's what I feel
journal.
Like. That probably worked much better at the time than I feel like it does now. Which is, I feel like with this framing device,
oh, yes.
Books, like of
well,
like,
and also that what they were talking about. This was posted in subscription, right? That it was originally posted in chapters in like a journal or like a
no, it was serialized in a magazine, but it was the same thing. It started with like that prologue from the doctor being like, these are like this is an account that like this woman gave, but like.
So I feel like a lot of things like this, especially horror, was kind of published that way rather than in a book. So I feel like those kind of interesting framing devices of like articles and letters works a little better in that format of when you're getting it like, you know, every month or whatever, like, you know, it kind of builds you in and fits into like the world and world builds a little different than
well,
when you're
even
reading it as
when
a book.
Laugh and you republished it, it was in what was it kind of got up on here?
Oh, it was like
In a Glass Darkly, which was a collection of a bunch of short stories he had written, but they were all supposed to be the papers of that occult doctor.
Yes.
So like it was just one of the stories within that like this was a case he investigated.
Right.
Which is like almost thinking about it like serialized thing, it was like, you know, here's an X-Files episode and here's an X-Files episode, but like, you know, it's coming out over the course of 6 months in literally a magazine.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Sorry.
All right. Well,
I was
reading
a thing about vampires. Because so, it's not just a European thing.
No, vampires are one of those, like,
they're literally in every culture.
Universal myths.
I do like, I can say one thing real quick. You know how the European ones are like, oh, they suck your blood and everything. I do like how some other cultures, like, specifically, I know in the Jiangxi of Chinese culture, specifically, it doesn't feed on blood. The Jiangxi eats your ki, which is like your life force.
Mm-hmm.
But they're weird because like they also jump around and stuff.
Right.
But yeah, I just like that the different cultures do are like, no, they feed on this. But it's always life.
Which it clearly
it
has
is
to
a
do
life
with
source.
Disease.
Yes. Oh, yeah. 100%.
It's clearly some kind of probably tuberculosis a lot.
So like
of
werewolves
times.
Are just a representation of like wild animals.
Right.
People.
And probably also rabies.
Oh, well, definitely rabies.
Right.
Yeah. Or actually, I know this isn't on topic, but
werewolves actually, a lot of people who were bipolar, they thought to be werewolves because they every time they would have a manic episode, they were thought to be going through a
a transformation.
Yeah.
Same with seizures, actually. Epilepsy was another.
Well, and they mentioned that in this where that.
Yeah.
Yes,
one of her governesses said that, like, when she was told to stay with her, that she assumed that the doctor thought she was going to have a seizure fit.
Yes, the doctor tells, Madame Peridon, that she can't believe Laura's side.
Yeah.
Because they worried she was going to have fits. So I guess we've gone pretty long.
I feel like this has been about where we are with our recent episodes.
Your guys' recent episodes. Mine have been a little bit shorter. All right. So Vampire Month will continue 1 week after this.
Vampire Month or 2 months.
Or 2 months. Yeah, we've been talking this.
Vampire Month number 2, double fanged.
Yeah. Vampire Month might continue till October. Who knows? All right. Anyway.
To ghosts.
The next episode will be, because I mentioned it, I feel like, far too many times, we'll be watching the first season of Carmilla, the web series. I guess I'll probably link that in here if anyone would like to continue it, and I will send the two of you the link to it. It is on Kind of TV on YouTube. I know there is a playlist that is just the first season. And we would just be doing the first season. That is mostly, maybe later we'll do episodes on the later seasons and then the movie. But the closest kind of adaption of the novella is just the first season. So we will be talking about that next week. All right. So
are we going to also combine that with do we want to do other adaptations at all?
At least I guess we could watch those and you could explain how other.
Maybe I'll bring in some of the other adaptations on it too. Yeah, I'll talk about the other adaptations too because, okay. So I guess Carmilla, the series and the web series will
and
be
various
the main focus. We also talk about some various adaptations. Of it. So, if you have anything to say to us about Carmilla or other vampire things, we are hyperfanpod@gmail.com and hyperfanpod on Twitter and Tumblr. You know how to spell the name of our podcast because a
podcast.
Our podcast because it's hyperfixation.
They didn't know how to spell our podcast. Our last.
Our podcast. Yes.
So the didn't podcast know in the
our
past.
Podcast past. Freak a child, but now you're just hyperfixation. You know how to spell that. All right. So.
We're drunk.
Yes, we are drunk, and I guess we will see all of you at Silas University next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Rajashimi.
Kawashi.
Wait, I felt like there was something I was going to say, but I can't remember what it was.
You can call me now. I'll throw hands.
Fuck, I don't remember. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what
it's
doing.
So,
in these cases, it seems to yearn for something like sympathy. Oh my god.
Oof.
Like.
Okay, we're being normal now?
Is it working normally?
We're being normal now. Okay, cool.
Okay.
We figured it out. Okay.
Ah.
It's working. Okay. Which they do play up.
Because yes. I gotta pee. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
I feel like we need to learn some other like fantasy goodbye. Like Elvin, like Lord of the Rings goodbye or some shit.
I really was trying to hit stop there and I just hit record again. So we caught that. So that will be our outro. Bye.